picked up. We actually, like, we would prefer these situations to not be so dramatic, but because of how ICE works and how the immigration courts work, we only managed to get an emergency stay for him granted on Friday. And this was after I had filed the stay maybe a month and a half before the flight. We knew everything about the flight, like when it would leave, when it would land. And on a daily basis, I would call the Board of Immigration Appeals, where we were trying to reopen Sir Un's order, and I would leave them a voicemail on a daily basis. In the last week before he was scheduled to leave his family and his only home behind, I called the Board of Immigration Appeals on an hourly basis. I'm not a pushy person, but I would call them on the hour just to remind them that this father of two and soon to be three was about to be sent away. We actually even had to file a federal lawsuit in the Southern District of California in order to get ICE to try to force the BIA to act on a decision. It ended up being a very dramatic moment because they had already transferred my client out of the San Diego ICE facility to Arizona. We wanted them to stop the flight from Arizona to Texas, but he boarded the flight. And then midway on the flight, the ICE officers received an email. They took Sir aside. They told him, we're not sure what exactly happened, but you're not going to get off in Texas. So Sir was in a weird situation where he watched around 30-something of his countrymen essentially get off the plane in tears, ready for deportation, and he had no idea what was
happening. We just have 5 seconds. Where is he now?
I caught up with him. Sir is currently in Arizona, and we're hoping he will be released today. It's also his daughter's 4th birthday today.
Kevin Lowe, we want to thank you for being with us with the Immigrant Rights Program at Asian Americans Advancing Justice. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a social media job opening. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the 4th Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
From the radio station that brought you the Fall Drive thank you spot comes an on-air acknowledgement so controversial it will blow your mind.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's holiday membership drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
Oh, the humanity!
Our end-of-year fundraising campaign is still going on. Go to kboo.fm/give to donate right now.
Radio will never be the same again.
Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Port Orchard tornado, U.S. troops leaving Syria, and in international news, Disney has an issue with the language of Swahili. Good
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 19th, 2018. I'm Carly Meisberger.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. Everyone wants the Elliott State Forest, Oregon's largest state forest, including two nearby counties, two tribes, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and a nonprofit Christian group. Yesterday, the State Land Board voted to start work on a plan to transfer the 80,000-acre forest near Coos Bay to Oregon State University, creating the Elliott State Research Forest. Since endangered species, court rulings limited lodging and the forest stopping generating money, as required for Oregon's Common School Fund, the state has been considering what to do with the forest. Last year, the legislature approved $100 million in bonds for the local fund, but an additional $121 million is needed to compensate the fund for the Elliott's appraised value, which OSU will need to come up with. The research forest plan would include a mix of uses on the forest, including managed harvesting, recreation, and conservation.
Port Orchard, a small city 13 miles west of Seattle, was hit by a tornado yesterday. While hundreds of homes were damaged and a couple thousand lost power, no one was killed or seriously injured. Washington State has an average of 2.5 mostly mild tornadoes a year, and only averages 1/100th of a tornado a year in December. Another strong windstorm is expected to hit the Puget Sound area, as well as Portland, tonight and tomorrow.
Cannabis Radio News is a weekly program dedicated to giving you the latest on national cannabis news. In this edition of the Cannabis Radio News, we get the latest from Vancouver, BC, California, and Pennsylvania in exactly 300 seconds of pure marijuana news.
This is the Cannabis Radio News. I'm Brian Behuth. Since last week, when Health Canada, the overseer of the nation's medical cannabis program, sent cease and desist emails to 13 marijuana dispensaries around the country, a store in Saskatoon is voluntarily closed. But in Vancouver, even though Health Canada threatens criminal prosecution from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Vancouver Police Board voted last week to dismiss a complaint alleging the police department failed to enforce the law against illegal marijuana dispensaries. Pamela McColl of the group Smart Approaches to Marijuana Canada brought the complaint and accused the VPD of neglecting its duty to maintain law and order. But according to a CBC interview, VPD Deputy Chief Doug Lepard said that his officers are duty-bound to prioritize which criminal activity most impacts public safety. He added that regulations for cannabis dispensaries passed last summer by the Vancouver City Council are proving effective in their management of the retail outlets, and that his officers would indeed take action against dispensaries that pose a public safety threat, should one do so. In Olympia, Washington, the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board and the Suquamish Tribe have signed the nation's first state tribal marijuana compact. Legislation, HB 2000, enacted during the 2015 legislative session, enabled the compact that effectively governs the production, processing, purchase, and sale of marijuana on tribal land. The mutual agreement is significant for the fact that federal Indian law precludes the state from enforcing its civil regulatory laws in Indian country. In that spirit, the bill is intended to further the government-to-government relationship between the state of Washington and federally recognized Indian tribes by authorizing the governor to enter into agreements concerning the regulation of marijuana. Such cooperative agreements are meant to enhance public health and safety, ensure a lawful and well-regulated marijuana market, encourage economic development, and provide fiscal benefits to both the tribes and the state. The signed compact moves to Governor Jay Inslee for approval. Upon final signature, the compact remains in effect for 10 years. In California, the news that lawmakers passed sweeping new regulations for the state's vast medical cannabis program overshadowed the quiet death of another important drug-related bill, SB 443, an asset forfeiture reform bill authored by Senator Holly Mitchell, a Democrat from Los Angeles, and David Hadley, a Republican from Torrance. The measure would have required a conviction in either state or federal court before property could be permanently forfeited to local law enforcement coffers, but despite bipartisan support and nearly unanimous votes at every previous juncture, the bill failed to pass the assembly floor in the final hours of the 2015 session after extraordinary efforts by law enforcement to defeat it. Tactics reportedly included calls to legislators' personal cell phones. And in Pennsylvania, a group of religious leaders have launched a website to collect signatures from fellow clergy urging the Pennsylvania General Assembly to pass meaningful medical marijuana legislation. On the Clergy for a New Drug Policy website, organizers call for an end to the war on drugs, and in a religious declaration for new drug policy, authors argue the United States has waged war at home and abroad for over 40 years and has yet to achieve its stated objectives. Instead, writing on the website asserts the war on drugs has only deepened divisions between rich and poor, black, white, brown, and squandered over $1 trillion in turning the United States into a prisoner nation. The declaration points out that the U.S. spends $215 billion a year for prisons, police, and courts that enforce mandatory minimum sentencing, seizures of property without due process, indiscriminate and highly discriminatory police sweeps of entire neighborhoods, and the privatizing of prisons. And perhaps most important, even though drug use is roughly equivalent across ethnic groups, the vast proportion of those in jail are people of color, and that young black men in most states are more likely to go to prison than college, and that the ideology of this war is now embedded in our institutions and needs to change. That's our show for this time. I'm your host, Brian Behuth, and I hope to catch you next time for another edition of the Cannabis Radio News.
Cannabis Radio News is an offering of Marijuana Public Media and is made possible in part by a grant from KVMR Radio and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For more, visit us at marijuanapublicmedia.org.
We have defeated ISIS in Syria, Donald Trump tweeted this morning. And since ISIS was, quote, my only reason for being there, quote, he will be withdrawing the over 2,000 U.S. troops currently in Syria. In August, the Pentagon estimated that as many as 14,500 ISIS fighters were still in Syria. Surprised by Trump's announcement, the State Department canceled a scheduled press briefing, while the Pentagon said withdrawal planning has just started and offered no timetable. A U.S. withdrawal would mean abandoning the U.S.'s closest ally inside Syria, the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, which has done most of the fighting against ISIS and is itself being threatened with attacks from Turkey.
Hakuna Matata, besides being a catchphrase and song from Disney's Lion King, is a long-standing Swahili phrase meaning, and quote, no problem. Over 52,000 people have signed a petition saying Disney's 2003 trademark of the phrase is a problem. Shelton Mapala, who created the petition, accused the company of appropriation. Disney can't be allowed to trademark something that it didn't invent, he said. Hakuna Matata, first made popular in 1982 by the Kenyan band The Mushrooms, is part of East African culture, with merchandise using the phrase sold to tourists. 3 years ago, Disney had applied to trademark the term Dia de los Muertos, the traditional Mexican Day of the Dead, for merchandising its animated film Coco, but dropped the application after receiving angry protests online. A remake of The Lion King will come out in June.
Climate Connections is a daily module that moves climate change away from debate and focuses on how it's impacting listeners' lives. On today's segment, anchors report on what diverse people and organizations are doing to reduce the associated risks and connect the dots between climate change and energy, public health, extreme weather, food, water, jobs, and the economy, national security, and more.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In San Diego, some commercial building owners are working to drastically reduce energy use. They've come together to form a coalition called a 2030 District. Members each commit to cutting energy use, water use, and transportation emissions in half by the year 2030. San Diego is one of 20 cities in North America to create one of these districts. Jason Anderson is CEO of CleanTech San Diego, which helps manage the local effort.
We will be working with those building owners to help them understand how they're using energy and then also give them proactive approaches to helping them reduce their energy.
Anderson says solutions can be as simple as swapping out conventional light bulbs for more efficient LEDs. But bigger changes are needed too, like smart technologies that can automatically adjust thermostat settings or turn off lights in empty rooms. That saves energy and reduces electricity costs, a combination that appeals to participants.
It's not only good for the environment, but it's also good for their bottom line, and they understand that.
So far, more than 50 San Diego buildings are included in the district. Anderson expects their successes will inspire other owners across the city to join them. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
According to the scanner, the Federal Transit Administration, or FTA, today announced that it has awarded a total of $16.6 million to 20 organizations around the country to support comprehensive planning projects that improve access to public transportation. Funding will be made available through FTA's pilot program for transit-oriented development, TOD, planning. This will assist communities that are developing new or expanded mass transit problems. The pilot program from TOD Planning provides funding to project sponsors who will integrate land use and transportation planning efforts with eligible transit projects. The grants will fund comprehensive planning to support transit ridership, multitude connectivity, and mixed-use development near transit stations. The program is authorized through fiscal year of 2020.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo. At 6, it's Say It Out Loud. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, you'll hear Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather is an increasing chance of rain with a low of 47. Tomorrow will be wet and blustery with an 80% chance of rain, wind gusts up to 38 miles per hour, and a high of 54. Today in history, in 1998, President Bill Clinton was impeached for lying under oath and obstructing justice. The quote of the day is from Charles Dickens, whose story, A Christmas Carol, was first published on this date in 1843. Reflect upon your present blessings, of which every person has many, not on your past misfortunes, of which all have some.
Modern Radio Theater is a weekly program produced by Dave McGotty, and this series is written and performed by a radio veteran, thespian, and Pacifica volunteer.
Thank you for listening to Modern Radio Theater. Today's program is entitled The Code of Many Colors. Royal Red was having a bad day. He was feeling blue because his brunette spouse was green around the gills. The sky was gray, and Royal Red stopped to look at his orange trees. He had pretty yellow morning glories and purple pansies, but he was missing his strawberry spread for his brown toast. His sweetie was out late in the blackness of night under a blue moon, while Royal Red fell asleep on the brown leather sofa watching Blue Bloods and Green Arrow on his TV. His dog, Ginger, has a white cyst on her pink underbelly. That next morning, the yolk from his eggs and the golden brown sausage went together nicely with his green tea for breakfast. That afternoon, Royal Red was going to see the Blue Angels fly at the Silver Streak Airport. Just then, an orange-breasted robin was caught red-handed by a calico cat that lay hidden in the ivy plants. Royal Red's buddy, Smokey Brown, was coming over to drop off some Kentucky bluegrass. Smokey was always tan from working in the hot yellow sun under clear blue skies. Royal Red's sister, Scarlet, always camouflaged her emotions around Smokey Brown. He once asked Scarlet Red to go with him to see the fall colors in the mountains, but she brilliantly refused because she is colorblind. Royal Red and Smokey Brown are true red, white, and blue, from their pearly white teeth to their tangerine socks. They are blue bloods who love the poem, "Roses are red, violets are blue, Road signs are green and frogs are too. Whitey is a friend of Royal Red's. They grew up together in their Green Meadows subdivision. Royal's house was the third white one on the right, and Whitey's was the yellow one across the street. The Brown family owns a bakery in town where they make cherry fritters and lemon bars, as well as orange marmalade jelly. Royal Red's family owns a shoe store specializing in blue suede shoes and oxblood leather sandals. Royal Red's family is selling online to build future customers who shop with a click instead of by brand association and color or artwork. Whitey Brown studied economics in college and is aware of the power of color branding. The human brain gathers and processes visual stimuli, and we associate our likes and dislikes with that visual info. See, the Red family has no concern for color in their bakery. A strawberry pie is strawberry, and a chocolate cake is, well, chocolate. Food production will not have as much trouble competing in the digital future like cars and clothes, brand names and products designed just for women or men. The idea of product identification will change in the coming decades. Everything changes constantly, from new to standard to weathering away. Color can change your mind, change actions, and create a reaction in our world. Color can irritate or soothe. Color can raise your blood pressure or suppress your feelings. When we spend money, do we think about the quantity of green bills? Are we interested in space exploration because there is not enough color on Mars or Jupiter? This is the code of color, and Royal Red loves to see the day's events in all of its brilliant colors. Do you think about the color of your day? Do you think about the colors of the future? Do you think about the colors of the people of Earth? Quite a wonderful selection of colors in this world of ours, don't you think? Join us again on this radio station for another edition of Modern Radio Theater.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs failed to address accounts of verbal abuse, bullying, and even physical intimidation carried out by former BIA Director Brian Rice during his short 6 months in the post. That's according to a report by High Country News that received documents from the Department of Interior's Office of Inspector General. They pertain to Rice's tenure at the agency and shed light on his sudden departure last April. The news organization says 4 out of 6 complaints were the subject of 3-month investigations. 2 complaints were documented and closed. There's no record of officials in the Interior Department taking any action to address the alleged behavior. Last March, several media outlets reported BIA Freedom of Information Officer Jessica Rogers sent an email to tribal leaders calling Rice, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, quote, an insidious perpetrator of harassment. She detailed an incident inside the Washington, D.C. headquarters in which she met Rice face-to-face for the first time and claims Rice acted aggressive and intimidating. Rogers told High Country News that reporting Rice's behavior to his superiors only made the situation worse, and the inappropriate actions are carried throughout the agency. The allegations of harassment are only one of the many troubling accounts that plagued the agency run by Ryan Zinke, who announced over the weekend he's stepping down. Tribal leaders and lawmakers are watching for any progress on legislation known as Savannah's Act when the U.S. House of Representatives convenes again this week. The bill was unanimously approved in the Senate, but has yet to be introduced in the House. The bill was authored by outgoing North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp. It aims to improve communication among federal, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies, give tribes better access to criminal databases, and issue regular reports on activities among jurisdictions. It's named for Savannah Marie Graywind, who was murdered last year in Fargo. Heitkamp, a Democrat who lost a re-election bid in November, blames the holdup in the House on Representative Bob Goodlatte, a Republican from Virginia. In a tweet last month, Heitkamp said Goodlatte is playing petty politics. Goodlatte has not spoken publicly about the issues with the bill. Goodlatte is retiring from his seat at the end of this term. The Republican candidate defeated in her bid for a congressional seat from New Mexico says further legal action to contest the election is possible. State Representative Yvette Harrell narrowly lost the election in November to Democrat Xochitl Torres-Small for the state's second congressional seat. Harrell is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, but did not mention her native heritage during the campaign. Harrell was ahead in the vote count when the counting stopped election night, but she lost her lead as election officials started counting absentee ballots they hadn't gotten to yet. Harrell has yet to concede the election. On her Facebook page, Harrell said her team is looking into various reports of inconsistencies in the results, which she says are needed to ensure the integrity of the election. A judge allowed her campaign to examine the absentee ballots and various other elections documents, a process her legal team has completed. Elections officials maintain all the ballots and procedures are in order. Harrell has until January 6th to contest the results of the election. The Navajo Nation Council delegates are meeting in a three-day special session beginning Wednesday. Among the issues they intend to tackle is an override of outgoing President Russell Begay's veto of a Veterans Advisory Council bill. The delegates approved the bill in October, changing the role of the veterans group. The council started in 2016 as a panel to recommend policy to the president on veterans affairs. The change switched oversight to the Navajo Nation Council and established a board of commissioners. At the time, Begay said the council failed to get adequate input from all those involved. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is in a holiday daze.
Here's how the year's ending. At the movies, you can see Mary Poppins or Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Choose your mythology. It's what the holidays are all about. This week, a judge sentenced a serial deer poacher to jail and monthly viewings of Bambi. Another judge told the Forest Service they, like the Lorax, need to speak for the trees have no tongues. While the prez is rarely sure what month it is, he makes every day a holiday for the media. And with more cold and crazy on the way, why not celebrate? The sun will come back. The rain may pause. Turn off your devices. Release your inner glow. Love the ones you're with. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
An internet troll who harassed a black college student, Taylor Dumpson, using racist messages on social media, has agreed to a court settlement. That settlement includes a written apology and an on-video statement publicly denouncing white supremacy. Dumpson's lawsuit says the Daily Stormer publisher Andrew Angelin directed his site's readers to cyberbully her after she became the first black woman to serve as American University's student government president.
A man seen as a fixture or leader in Oregon's white nationalist movement was hospitalized after an altercation with anti-fascist activists in Corvallis. Marr is known for driving a pickup truck around the state with racist and anti-Semitic messages on the sides of the truck. Police say a fight involving this white nationalist, Marr, and five other people erupted in downtown Corvallis around 4 p.m. Corvallis Police Lieutenant Dan Duncan said four people were jailed and, quote, suspicion of disorderly conduct, and later were released. Duncan says he doesn't know what prompted the fight. In an interview with the newspaper last year, Marr advocated for the extermination of Jewish people.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 19th, 2018. Here are the main points again. A tornado in Port Orchard, U.S. troops are leaving Syria, and in international news, Disney has an issue with the language of Swahili. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, the producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is David Koisters. The directors of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Carly Meisberger. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO.
At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 is Sojourner Truth Radio, and looks back on the history of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, including some of the women who played pivotal roles in the organization. At 9, it's Press Watch, with Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, on Fight the Empire welcomes author Jeremy Kazimorov, author of The Russians Are Coming, the first Cold War as tragedy, the second as farce. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman welcomes Layli Long Soldier to talk about Whereas, a collection of poems that confronts the U.S. government's coercive language in dealing with Native American people and tribes. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate. I'm Rachel Hartley.
I'm Carly Meisberger.
And have a good evening. Thank you, David.
When you try.